You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. If you drive a car in Southern California, you'll be reminded over and over of one thing, the drought. There are billboards telling people to be on the lookout for water wasters. The electronic signs used for amber alerts and road hazard warnings have defaulted to drought warnings. Farming economists estimate some $5 billion will be lost this year because of the dry conditions. And that doesn't count the losses to places like car washes. So we wanted to put the costs of the drought in context. And we sent producer John Sepulvedo out to talk to a small business owner. Hi, John.
Hi, Lizzie.
Tell us where you went and who you talked to.
So there's this private lake in Corona, California. It's about 60 or so miles east of Los Angeles. And this lake sells fishing access. So if you don't have a fishing permit, you could just show up at the lake, pay about $75 for 3 days worth of fishing. And lots of families come here. They bring their camping gear. They have picnics on the shore. And this lake is about as big as 100 football fields or so.
So small, but not too small.
Exactly. So anyways, I show up. I meet the manager. I tell him I'm looking to talk about the drought. And right away, he waves me over.
Come here and I'll show you.
What's his name?
Jimmy Davis. They call him JD. He's a big, tall guy, trucker cap, fishing t-shirt, Marlboro Reds kind of man. And he's taking me to a trailer that serves as an office here.
You see this picture here?
In this picture, boaters are waving towards the camera and families are on the banks fishing. It's a real idyllic scene.
You see how far back into the trees the water goes?
There is a lot of water and it goes high into the trees, maybe about 9 or 10 feet.
Now, come around here and I'm going to show you something.
And so at this point, we start walking away from the trailer.
And where are you guys going?
He's taking me to the edge of the water, and it's a lot longer walk than it was when that picture was taken about 5 or 6 years ago, because this lake looks like a big, green, algae-filled puddle. And Lizzie, this is what the drought in California sounds like.
What is that sound?
These are shells. They are freshwater clam shells, and there are thousands of them all around, dried up on the shore. This is the carcass of the freshwater lake here in Corona, California.
The deepest part of the lake right now is 8 feet. And when this is full, it's about 22, 23 feet.
So it's down almost about 17 feet, somewhere in there.
Yeah, and the thing about it is right now we had water coming in back here in the back to kind of hold the level the right where it's at, but they cut the water off. Now, if the water keeps going down, the shad and crappie will start dying. When that happens, everything in this lake's going to die.
So for our listeners maybe in New York or somewhere else, what are shad and...
Shad is a bait fish. Crappie is a fish that a lot of people go after because they're one of the best eaten fish that you can get, okay?
So when those fish go, you're saying everything else in this lake goes, what happens to your business at that point?
We'll close the doors. Actually, it's up in the air as to how long this lake will stay open.
How much money would this private lake lose if you were to shut the doors?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And JD, how long have you been working here?
Been working for this company for 17 years.
What would you do?
Well, I'd go on Social Security disability. Okay? Simple as that.
Have you ever seen the water this low? Have you ever seen the conditions this bad?
I've never seen the water in this lake this low. The customers are asking me how long do I think that we'll be open. I can't answer that question because I don't know. Okay? If I start seeing fish dying.
And at this point, Lizzie, he's trying to say it's over. Once these fish are dead, there's no oxygen left in the lake, meaning the lake is dead.
John, this is a private lake. There are only a handful of these things left in California. How did you find this place?
You know, my brother used to come up here to fish in the late 1990s, and I used to drive him. For me, I grew up in Southern California, and it's weird to think that this lake that has weathered drought since 1934 could just disappear like this. I mean, the loss of revenue is awful. We just heard JD say it's going to be about several hundred thousand dollars a year for this family. But I think about my brother even. He's going to take his kids by here someday and he's going to say, hey, you see that big dry hole? Well, I used to fish there. And it's a conversation I wouldn't even have imagined 5 years ago.
Producer John Sepulveda joined us from the Marketplace studio in Los Angeles. Thanks, John.
Anytime, Lizzie.
You You just heard how the Western drought could force the closure of a small business in Southern California. But drought conditions aren't just local. There is significant drought on every inhabitable continent. And that got us wondering what big companies are doing about that drought, say, a company like Coca-Cola.
Well, so Coca-Cola, a little over a decade ago in India, got quite a shock when some local farmers near one of its bottling plants started complaining about its water use.
That's Polita Clark. She's the environment correspondent for the Financial Times, and she recently wrote a series called A World Without Water. And she says that moment when Indian farmers complained about Coca-Cola's water usage spurred the company to start conserving and preserving water. In England, Coca-Cola took what had essentially become an industrial drainage ditch and turned it back into a river.
Because they wanted to improve the quality of water that was flowing through it. And so it's quite interesting. I mean, there was a relationship with Coca-Cola in as much as some of the sugar beet that they grow in the UK to sweeten the drinks that they make here. Some of that's grown along the river, and fertilizer runoff from that sugar beet can be a problem for the river. It is nonetheless quite unusual for a company to spend that sort of money on such an odd project just to really try to improve the quality of water in around its operations.
You have some startling numbers in the stories that you have put together, including that companies have spent some $84 billion over the last 3 years on water reclamation projects, improving conservation, etc. Why are they doing this? What's in it for them?
Well, there's a range of different reasons. I mean, sometimes they do it because of physical water shortages. You know, sometimes these newer environmental regulations are forcing this to happen. In other cases, a changing climate can lead to some quite significant expenditures. In other cases, companies are either getting ahead of or responding to environmental regulations that are basically saying we can no longer have you just discharging wastewater that's fairly toxic or polluted back into a river or a stream. They're spending a huge amount of money collectively on that sort of plant and equipment.
I think a lot of people view water as something perhaps endless or boundless. They turn on the tap. They maybe don't think twice about it. And yet you have written this series of stories with the heading A World Without Water. When you started reporting these stories, did it change your view about the amount of water we consume as a planet?
I think what it did drive home to me was what we really mean when we talk about a global water crisis. This is something that, you know, the World Bank, the UN, and other bodies have been warning about for 20 years or more. And what really has become evident to me is that, we're talking about a global water mismanagement crisis. In other words, water is really poorly distributed. You know, if you and I were in charge, we wouldn't create a world in which something like, 60% of world water supplies are in only sort of 9 or 10 countries. And even within those countries, it's really poorly distributed. And then it's long been taken for granted. It's been mismanaged. It's been polluted. It's been overallocated. And so what we're seeing in country after country is growing competition between the two biggest users of water. Number one, farmers, who globally use about 70% of water, and number two, industry, companies, who use around a fifth of fresh water supplies. And so it's that growing competition between those two groups that is really becoming more and more intense in a lot of places. And that's something that a number of companies are really focusing on. In fact, Google's really interesting. You know, the head of their data centers operations said, I think it was 2009, in fact, they recognized that there's been a huge amount of focus on climate change and carbon emissions, and that was all fine. But once the public started realizing how crucial and how strained water supplies were, then data centers, for example, which can use hundreds of thousands of gallons a day, depending on their size, they're really going to be coming under the spotlight. And water is going to be the next big elephant in the room, according to Google, for data center operators. So, you know, I think companies are generally starting to realize that if they don't try to grapple with this problem, it's something that's going to become much more serious for them in future.
there was something that a Nestle executive told you that made my eyebrows go up when I read your story, which was, we're going to run out of water long before we run out of oil. And that threw this into relief in a way that, frankly, I don't think I knew.
Yeah, I mean, that was Peter Brabeck, the chairman of Nestle. And I mean, I guess it's a contested view, but, you know, you can see why in certain parts of the world it's possible that this could happen, although I don't know. I mean, one gets into a lot of difficult arguments about peak oil and peak water, but certainly one thing that's interesting is that, you know, we've had this debate about peak oil, you know, for when the world is really likely to seriously run out of affordable oil supplies. We've had that debate for many years, but now people are starting to talk about peak water. And that's a relatively new phenomenon, and it's one I think that we're going to be hearing a lot more about.
If you are going about your day in different countries around the world, how do you think people will start to feel the impact of either a global water shortage or how different countries, different companies start to manage that response to a global water shortage?
One of the reasons that we don't look at the global water crisis in quite the same way as we do with global warming and climate change is because, to a large extent, we are talking about a series of local dilemmas rather than an absolutely global situation.
I have just one last question for you. In your story, you talk about the almost unconscious way we often think about water, where you might not even be able to recall your first memory of it. I'm wondering if you can.
Gosh, I think my first memory of water was probably playing in the bath and dreading having my hair washed, probably is another very close second on that.
Polita Clark, environment correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We've been talking about how people and businesses use water. Some groups look at drought and see a way to make money. One of them is the Las Vegas Global Economic Alliance. Tom Skanke is its president and CEO. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You have this new public-private water partnership. Tell me about that and explain what it is.
So the Water Center of Excellence, which is housed here in Las Vegas, is the first time that in our state's history where we have brought the private sector and the public sector together. And what this really is a unique partnership of taking all of the research and all of the technology that our community has done over the past 30 years, house that under one center of excellence, and then turn that into an economic development and commercialization opportunity that has never existed here for us.
I mean, I think of Vegas as, frankly, a tourism place and a place where, you know, there's been a big housing economy. You're saying that this is potentially a new economic revenue stream for the area?
Absolutely. Most people know Las Vegas was one of the most hard-hit communities in the country during the Great Recession. This community was demoralized. We had an economy of development and tourism, and I refer to that as kind of a codependency because we needed one to have the other and vice versa. When we went through the recession, neither one of those two industries did extremely well. So we went, as a nation, we went through a great reset. But as a region and as a community, the Southern Nevada area went through a great reset. We realized about 3 years ago that we could no longer rely upon these two industries going forward to be the only two economic engines in our state. So we've created new partnerships that have never existed before. We've brought organizations together that historically had been competitors and put them under one umbrella and have tried to change the way the world looks at Las Vegas beyond the boulevard to let people know that there's a lot more going on here in the tech industry. Take all of that technological knowledge, all of the research knowledge, and then the Southern Nevada Water Authority, which is the application knowledge. This is a whole new industry for us, and we're promoting it. We went to the International Water Week in Singapore just a couple of months ago and had great results. We signed up two clients in the first day and probably put together another 20 opportunities for Southern Nevada and the Water Center of Excellence going forward. So we're very proud of the work, and we think the future of this Center of Excellence is very bright.
When you look around the globe at other places that are experiencing drought, do you see kind of a drought market opening up for your group?
Oh, good question. Yeah, I do, actually. And this is a whole new marketplace that I don't think has ever been looked at or fully inspected properly. There is drought all over the planet, right? And these types of conversations are happening all over the world. I believe that we are at the front end of a global conversation of, one, water purity and conservation, but also water sustainability. Water resources is becoming a global conversation. You look at the strategic advantage that companies and industries have where there is a reliable water resource. Go back just 3 or 4 years and look at the state of Texas when they were talking. Think about this, the Rio Grande River drying up, right? You go to the Midwest and you'd have conversations with people in Nebraska about the Ogallala Aquifer becoming almost financially infeasible to drill any deeper because the water is so expensive at the level where they are drilling. It's a very valuable commodity. In fact, some people have written and speculated that the next war in this world will actually be around water, right? Because it is such a valuable commodity. It is a limited resource.
But is there any moral discomfort that comes from making money off of drought?
Moral discomfort. Wow. I don't think so. I think that if I can help a neighboring state solve an issue or a crisis around water, then I'm doing my job, right? But I think that if my region has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in that research or that technology, then I think I should be compensated, right? I mean, that's what capitalism is about, right? That's what our country is built on, is we can help other nations, but we should be paid for the work that we're doing. I mean, I don't think that these research professors and the engineers at the Water Authority should go without being compensated. I think that we should take their experience, their knowledge and understanding, package that and sell it and help the rest of the world. That, to me, that just makes sense as an entrepreneur, as a businessman, and as an American. And I think we'll be a leader in several conversations for water in the future.
Tom Skanke, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
And that brings us to the weekend number. The number is 10, or 15 if you're feeling really bullish. That's how many years the ratings agency Fitch says Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Tucson have before water supply issues start hurting economic growth. Lake Mead, home of the Hoover Dam, helps supply all three cities with water. It's now 100 feet lower than it was in the year 2000.